Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. As always, please check out the new YouTube channel. We had almost 500,000 views on that last month, but you need to subscribe. Don't just watch the great content and not subscribe. So there's a bit of a plea there. As we build the community, we build the opportunity as well. Now, the trial lawyer in me loves a little bit of evidence or research to support any kind of proposition. And we're still passionate about exploring all things leadership. So I was very excited when I had the opportunity to get Dr. Graham Curtis into the studio, who's part of the Roffey Park Institute. And their focus is really to prime organizations to build business skills for everyone and everywhere. And certainly they've got some charitable purposes as well, which struck a chord with me. So this is going to be a great and interesting conversation, not only about one person's perspective on leadership, but also what does the research start to tell us about the shifting landscape of leadership. Trust me, you don't want to miss this episode. Come back to me just after this break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Frank, it's a warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Adam. Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. And that was my very quick introduction, as it always is. And you're going to do a better job of telling me a story. So let's start a little bit about who is Dr. Graham Curtis?
Oh, so $64 million question, isn't it?
That almost sounds like therapy, doesn't it?
Who am I? So I work at Roffey Park Institute,
yes,
as you say, and I've been working there for about 2.5 years now,
right,
as an employee, although I have a long history with Roffey Park going back to 2007,
right,
which we can talk about if
yes,
you like.
Please.
So I'm the director of learning and research. My background is in operational leadership and management. That's where I've spent most of my time.
Right.
Only recently have I got into kind of leading research and academic endeavor. So I lead the master's program at Roffey Park, which is now a fully online international program, which we can also have a chat about, because I think that is really testing some of our assumptions about the subject of organizational development, which I'm passionate about, and kind of what it means to make healthy and sustainable organizations in different contexts, because the global nature of that is different in different contexts.
I
so
agree.
What works in some areas doesn't work in others, and I think we're really learning that from our masters. And we're now really serious about getting back to delivering research. So if I say a bit about Roffey Park's
history. Yeah, let's start there. Tell us a little, because Roffey Park has got a really interesting history, hasn't it, to it?
Yeah.
So to tell us about Roffey Park. When did it start? What was its original focus? And what has it become?
So just after the Second World War, there were lots of people interested in kind of how did that happen and how can we avoid that happening again, right? So
seem to get closer and closer to it.
I think we are in danger of potentially repeating some of the mistakes of the past. It's interesting, isn't it? Because generationally, we're probably at the point where anybody that was involved isn't alive anymore. So we've got stories of it, but we haven't got first-hand accounts a lot of the time.
My father is 93, so he's from that age group. Where
my granddad...
We're going to lose that, aren't we?
Well, I think. We've lost those first-hand stories. So we're now... The kind of memory might be starting to drift, and we've got stories, but we haven't got the actual people to tell them.
It's a big deal, isn't it?
It's
a lost generation.
Well, the generation that went through that process, my granddad he died when I was about 10. He died in his early 70s, but he was in a prisoner of war for 4 years during the war. His story is, can you imagine living during the war? Because we know the end of the war and what the result was, but they didn't at the time. Being in a prisoner of war camp in Poland for 4 years, not knowing whether you were ever going to get home.
So, but Roffey started just after that.
Just after the war, and it was the British government with a group of supporting companies, sponsoring companies, who were interested in the rehabilitation of workers. Essentially to make workers more productive, because that was the point. The investment in the research was about how can we bring workers back to the workplace and so that they're fully healthy and being more productive in the workplace? So the interest was, how can we have a positive impact on the physical, mental and spiritual well-being of workers?
Yes.
So there was an investment from a number of organisations, interestingly, tells you something about the time, one of which was Imperial Tobacco.
Right, okay.
Probably, there's we live in a different world, don't we? Yeah.
But let's be honest, that this is a population who had just either served in the military, indeed, lost loved ones, and lived through a war.
Yeah,
so there's
yeah.
There's a huge rehabilitation exercise here, isn't there?
And interestingly, you know, on International Women's Day...
Today.
Indeed it is. So it's very timely. You know, women had been a huge part of the war effort.
Yes.
And had served in all of the factories, you know, and women now had expectations in the workplace that they might not have had pre-war, right, and men were coming back from the war expecting to take up their workplace and finding them occupied by women. So there was a big sea change in terms of gender expectations as well around that time, and I think that's carried on to today. But going back to the genesis of Roffey Park, so there was this experiment going on. They bought a big stately home in Sussex called Roffey Park. And they brought scientists in, health experts, psychologists who were really thinking about how we think differently about what we're doing. And they started off a program that had, you know, that had a chapel, so it looked after their spirit, and there were people looking after their spiritual well-being. It had gardens that the participants worked in, so they grew food for the kitchens and they cooked their own food.
Right.
They don't cook their own food anymore at Roffey Park, I can assure you, Adam. We have a very good kitchen and restaurant.
One day, nevertheless, I'll come up and try it out.
You must come and have lunch or dinner with us. But it's one of the things that Roffey Park is renowned for is the food that we serve. But, and that has always been the case. So there was that. And then there was a number of programs around psychological well-being. And social well-being, so how we get on with other people.
Okay.
So that started to get results, and there was a lot of interest from around the world.
Yeah.
And what started to happen was people came to visit to see what was going on, and they were turned up at Roffey Park and kind of getting in the way of the work, do you know what I mean? Because there was lots of people who wanted to see it. So they bought an extra bit of land down the road called Beedingwood House, and that's where Roffey Park Institute is now. So Roffey Park Institute is isn't at Roffey Park.
So it shifted slightly.
Roffey Park's about a mile down the road, and they turned that stately home into a block of flats.
Oh, I could have guessed that would have been the outcome.
So it's a very tastefully done block of flats, but nevertheless, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And then Roffey Park Institute was formed on the grounds of Beedingwood House and still stays there on 47 or so acres of pasture.
It's quite a beautiful site from the pictures I've seen.
It really is. And so we've taken that idea of the physical and psychological well-being of people in the workforce into our charitable objectives. And we've been a charity for a long time. So all of our research and our endeavours, our academic delivery, our developing of leaders and managers is aimed at the sustainability and the well-being and the health of the workforce and the organisation. Right. So taking that well-being of the individual into the well-being and the health of the organisation, the sustainability of it. So that's what we still do. So we have a number of executive programmes delivering leadership and management development, as well as development of what we call organisational development practitioners, which is what our master's is aimed at, as well as kind of change managers and that kind of thing. So that's our niche around the human resource.
But again, towards those charitable objectives that...
Absolutely. Aimed at that. So the charitable objectives are about producing research into the health and well-being of the workforce.
Yeah.
And that's what we do.
And that's going to be the direction of travel for our conversation, because... Mm. I love a little bit of research. I think it's always useful as it starts to define and refine maybe our points of view. And let's be honest, the world is changing incredibly quickly. So we need constant research in order to try and pulse check or sense check where we are with things. So I'm going to cherry pick a little bit, a couple of pieces of research that you're working on. But also I'm going to ask you a little bit about your personal perspective and your journey as a leader. Because I think anyone who sits in the studio here and we talk about leadership, they've all had quite a unique set of experiences and then with a unique point of view as well. And that's what we're always trying to uncover. Let me start a little bit with some of the research that we briefly spoke about. I want to start with I think what you described as the forgotten workforce.
Yeah.
What do you mean by the forgotten workforce?
It's a bit of a trite title, but I think we got really interested post-pandemic about the people that we called essential workers. We're only in the embryonic stages of thinking about how we might research this, but we're very interested in actually most of the workforce that work to deliver things for organisations.
Yeah.
Are kind of on living wage or minimum wage, and the people that we banged pans for during the pandemic.
Do you know what? A lot of people have forgotten that we all did that at our front door at one point and banged pots and pans like some crazy comedy film, right? Or Ruprecht reminds you of the character in that in that film. I'm probably showing my age. But these things are easily forgotten, aren't they? We did all nationally bang pots and pans for certainly the NHS.
Mm.
We actually forgotten all about this already?
And I think we were banging pans for the people who had to go out and collect our rubbish in our bins, or the people, the carers who were caring for our elderly.
Sometimes the things we take for granted.
Yeah, the things we miss, you know. And unless you've got someone who's elderly and in a nursing home and you're seeing the carers do their excellent work, you know, it's easy to forget that they're there and what an important part they play in the maintaining the fabric of our society. We tend to focus a lot on the people at the top of organisations, don't we? Who've already had a huge amount of investment, you know, as you say, the C-suite. And we tend to forget.
But that's the few. And that's not the many, though.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the challenges, to be fair to organisations and to people making these judgments. The idea is you invest in the performance and the capability of the few at the top, and that will trickle down through the development of everyone underneath them. And I think historically, and this is something we'd be interested in testing in our research, you know, if you take the parallel to be the trickle-down economic idea, it's a bit of a busted flush these days. You know, people recognise that there's something wrong in that idea. It's not playing through the way perhaps we thought it might in the 80s, or some people thought it might in the 80s. And I think there's something to look at in terms of how we invest in leadership and management as well, and the idea that that will naturally trickle down, because I think there's lots of evidence to suggest that that might not be true.
So have we got it wrong? Because I'll give you just an example. I had an interesting conversation with one guest who was a very, very senior military officer in the UK, now retired, and talked about how much they recognise and develop leadership within the young officers coming through, not the senior in experience, because A, they are having to lead perhaps in life or death situations very early on. Interesting how we're linking this now to maybe to Roffey Park. But B, that was something to serve was to lead. Mm. I think that was the phrase.
Mm.
But when you talk about corporate life, it's completely flipped. You're going to have to wait many years before you A, get recognised and or rewarded potentially with leadership development programmes. Perhaps we're all guilty of that. Have we got it wrong?
I think I'd like to get some research to find that out. You know, because I think the other thing, I think research and evidence is really important.
I agree.
Because we find ourselves, I don't know what your experience is, but in organisational life, there's a lot of big decisions made on hunches and what the leader thinks might be the right answer.
And biases.
Yeah, of course. We're all biased, aren't we? But our bias shapes us, and we're often very unaware of it. That can be a helpful way of making decisions, because judgment's important. But I think it's not just judgment. How do we get the evidence and the research to give us some good perspective so our judgment is tested by the research and the evidence? So have we got it wrong? I think there's enough reason to think we might have, in terms of anecdotal experience. You know, my anecdotal experience is that I've worked in a lot of organisations, a lot of it in the public sector, to be fair, but also in the private sector and then the charity sector. There's a perpetuation, because the thing is, often you'll invest in some senior leaders, but they don't stay around somewhere very long. You know, they might be there 3, 4, 5 years.
That's an expensive asset that walks out the door, right?
You know, all of that investment's gone. The people who tend to stick around in organisations are people at that kind of first-line manager level, or the people who are doing the work. They stick around a long time. And I don't think there's a lot of evidence that a huge amount of investment goes into that group of people. But I would like to see it. I think
so maybe we haven't got it wrong, but maybe the balance needs to be readdressed.
Maybe. And I think we also have to recognise the challenge in that, because you can invest in a small number of people a lot for a relatively comfortable amount of money.
Yes.
Investing in a large number of people is a different endeavor. This is the same argument about taxation, isn't it? So when you cut taxes for a lot of people, that costs a lot of money in the end. So our economy tends to look at the end number.
Yeah.
And that looks like a very expensive endeavor. And yet, I think we probably need to think differently about what we're doing if we're going to get a different world.
Well, I would agree with you. Mm. So what are some of the kind of the key insights in relation to the forgotten workforce that are worth sharing?
Still early days.
Okay, but what kind of, are there certain things identifying themselves?
The things we'd like to start to look for.
Yeah, help us with that.
Is what tends to happen is people that are seen as having potential in the kind of lower levels of the organization are kind of plucked out and invested in to be the future senior leaders. And that, there's a number of ways organizations do that. Talent, development,
the high potentials.
All of those kind of ideas. And there's the research in education to suggest that when we identify someone as talent and invest in them, it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy because they start to believe that they're talent, and that belief leads through to them actually ending up being talented in the end. And it leaves others who are kind of saying, oh, I haven't been selected for a high talent.
Didn't get the opportunity,
high potential,
right?
So I might not be talented. And so it kind of limits their ideas about their potential. Certainly my early years would kind of bear that out, that there's a lot of that going on. So I'm curious as to how we make a broader impact on people's belief in their own potential. And I'm not sure that that would need a huge amount of investment. You know, I think the school I went to was a kind of sink comprehensive school in a large council estate in Sunderland in the northeast. You know, and I went to school during the 80s when the shipyards were closing down and the mines were closing down and potential wasn't easily recognised, and perhaps it was in the past. You know, so. Yeah. If you were clever, you'd go into the drawing office, or you'd go into leadership in one of those places. Or if you went to a secondary modern school before my time, you would have gone into the working workforce in the mines or in the shipyards. But there was a career path.
Yeah.
So when I grew up, that wasn't so clear. So how do you work with people across all of those spaces to find a way that they can think that they have potential? Because
to believe
the
in themselves.
Starting point is believing in yourself before anyone else will believe in you, right? And some of us were lucky. Some of us might have had teachers or someone in a parental space or someone in a quasi-parental space that gave us some of that belief. And some of us are not so lucky. And whether it's in the education space or whether it's in the early years of work, how do we invest something in giving everyone the idea that they have potential?
There's a social mobility piece here as well, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Just what opportunity is available to you, and where were you born, and what is your family structure, and all of these things, I think, they play a part. They must play a part, mustn't they, in relation to what is or is not available?
I think, certainly from my experience, I've found that to be true.
Yeah.
You know, so what's in front of you can affect, or what's around you can affect what you think potential means. You know, what does it mean to be successful in a context where success might mean just getting a good job and keeping it. Do you know what I mean? And I think that was certainly true in my early years, and I think it's true for a lot of people that come from the background that I do. And other people who have other role models in their lives can be more aspirational.
Yeah.
So how can we – maybe it's something about – and I know this has happened before, but it's really hard for people to – when you bring role models into schools or into the early workforce places – if there was role models, haven't got the kind of background that the people they're talking to have, it's hard to connect to them.
Yeah, I would agree.
Do you know what I mean? And you know, I've got huge admiration for senior leaders in the military or senior leaders in, the influences today are not necessarily the influences that were of my time.
Things have changed a little bit,
Graham.
It might
have more impact bringing in one of the influences of Instagram into a school than you might have anywhere else.
Yeah.
Certainly, that's true. You know, my son was much more interested in the people who had podcasts than necessarily a military leader or an industrial leader.
He'll be watching this one for sure. That's the first diktat that's gone.
But I digress. I think that bringing role models into these early places with people who are recognizable to them gives them a sense, well, if they can do it, maybe I can.
we talk about the power of the role of role modeling, and I'm going to come back to that because I want to talk to you a little bit about your journey. But what should leaders listening to this of small, medium, large organizations, what should they be looking out for or listening out for in relation to understanding their workforce and maybe the forgotten elements of their workforce? We have leaders here who have got organizations that are in the hundreds of thousands strong, located globally. Now, let's be realistic. They're not going to know each and every person within that business. So what could a leader or should a leader be thinking about?
It's a really good question, because I think this is a point for me that I think is really important. I think there are certain aspects of leadership that are common. So the idea that you can properly critically reflect on yourself and what's going on around you.
There's got to be a starting point, right?
You know, I think that's common for all of us if we want to be in a capable leader. Being able to deal with organizational politics and influence and all of those things, that's also important. And working ethically with those things is really key, and being able to think in that way. And I think whilst those things are common, every organizational context is different. And the way things work at the coalface, if I can use that phrase as a metaphor for the operational front end of a business.
Yeah.
I find in a lot of my experience, there's a gap between what actually happens on the ground and what the people at the top of the office thinks happens.
Yeah.
Because there's about four layers of management and leadership.
Well, there's a vacuum, isn't there?
And also, if you're at this in a senior leader position, because increasingly we've thought that you can move leadership around context, can't you? You can move a leader from a supermarket to I don't know, a football team.
They're still the good leader and they'll
I'm, whilst there's some common things about those, as I've said, I think the context's radically different. So I think as a leader, you really have to take time to really understand the context that you're working in and understand and test what is actually happening in whatever way you can. And it's difficult because it's like, I think leaders experience a bit of what the queen, or the king now, would experience when he turns up at the hospital.
The smell of fresh paint.
Exactly. So, and I think leaders of organisations are doing the same. So they come, it's very difficult for a leader to just turn up.
Yeah.
Because it scares the what's-its out of the people who are leading that particular area.
Yeah.
When a leader, so a leader's very sensitive. So if I turn up, I need them to know I'm coming. But when people know they're coming, they're going to spruce the place up and they're going to have a meeting with their team about what to say and what not to say and what message we want them to get.
Dot the I's, cross the T's. Paint the walls.
Leader turns up, gets the story they're expecting, goes away and thinks everything's tickety-boo. And finding an ability to really find out means you probably have to spend some time there.
Personally?
Yeah. So
Better listening systems.
I'll give you an example. So I used to work in the immigration department a long time ago. Most of the people who worked there when I worked there have retired now.
Right.
But you would find senior leaders making judgments about what should or shouldn't happen on the immigration control for good reason.
Yeah.
And they'd have a good logic behind them. And policymakers would write that policy for them. And that would end up in instructions for the people.
From up above.
The immigration people working on the border control.
Yeah.
You know? And there was often times when those kind of instructions would really jar with what the best thing to do would happen. You know, and it's a judgment call as to whether, I don't know whether that's still going on. It's been a long time since I was there. But then the difficulty is, if you close down the ability for the people at the front line to make judgments of their own about what to do, so to exercise their agency in their work, then they can't affect what should happen next. You know, I mean, the Toyota way that the Japanese, with some help from an American, created, that was aimed at getting some agency into the front line so that people can make their own judgments. If something wasn't working, they had the power to change it.
Well, they were best placed to assess make the change.
And I think some of that has either eroded or never happened in some industries. And I think bringing some of that back is probably important. And that means, as a leader, one of the things you really have to be able to cope with is not knowing, the uncertainty. Because change is made at the bottom end. Change what you think is happening.
Well, it's a two-way process, isn't it? It's not just top to bottom. But
and
there's
as you
also
say, when it's tens of thousands of people, it's really hard to get that comms right, isn't it?
So I'm going to actually pivot slightly and ask you a little bit about your personal journey. You know, you talked about, was it Grey up in Sunderland?
Yes. Have you ever been to Sunderland?
Do you know what? I'm just trying to think if I have been to Sunderland.
You've ever been to the Stadium of Light? You're a football fan, right?
I'm a big football fan. As I say, you are sat in the seat of...
Which means you've never been to the Stadium of Light, then, because you're a football fan. You want to see a lot of
that. We could discuss how Sunderland are now somewhere on their backside, aren't they, after an illustrious
career. We've had a tough time.
You have. Well, I mean, that's a big club with a huge following.
Yeah.
But I digress, because we could talk... I do love football. But you talked about a sink or stay, a comprehensive or whatever, in Sunderland. And so you've had a journey, and now you are the director of learning. You've done doctoral research.
Yeah.
So, you know, boy done good.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, that could be true.
So how did you manage? How did you manage the journey?
I want to be... there's a danger here of me rubbishing where I grew up, and I don't want... It's full of amazing people working really hard, bringing their families up in often difficult circumstances, but having a great time doing it. You know, if you go to the pubs or clubs in Sunderland now, you'll see people having a great time, and they're not worried about any of this stuff that we're talking about.
Make no mistake. I hear you loud and cloud, having lived myself partly up the north. You're going to find some of the best people, and on a human level, doing some of the most extraordinary things.
Yeah.
But I'm going to come back to forgotten.
Potentially so. And there's some people doing some great work in those places. It's pockets.
Pockets.
It's easy to generalise, but in some pockets life's really tough, and in some it's all right. You know, there are middle-class places in Sunderland, people doing really well. You know, so.
But what I want to know is, in the circumstances you found yourself in growing up, how did you believe in yourself and avail yourself to the opportunities that have brought you to where you are now? Is that a probably better question?
No, that's absolutely fine. So I can only talk about me.
Yeah, of course.
And it's the easy answer is, I don't know.
Opportunity knocked and here I am. Anyway,
I'll come back to it. But I think one thing I think is true of most of us, Adam.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, when you were 16, when did you leave school? 16, 18, did you go to university, 21?
I did.
So when you were 21, did you expect to be sitting here running a podcast?
No.
Okay.
This was a pandemic inspired event.
As it was for a lot of people. But, you know, or did you expect to be in whatever professions you've been in throughout the years? You might have done. Some people do. Most people don't. Most people end up somewhere. And I've ended up somewhere, not with a plan. I didn't have a plan to be director of learning. I didn't think I'd ever go to university.
Right.
I never went to university as a youngster. But I think there was always something in me that aspired for something else. And it's easy to say that now because I can only look back at
where
how
did that
I see
come
it now,
from? You know, so. Would that come from parents? Do you think
I can pick one or two teachers very early on?
Okay.
In fact, actually, I think one of the things that ironically had a positive impact was I was knocked down seriously. I was in the car knocked me down on the street where I lived when I was about 7.
Oh wow!
And I was took to hospital. They were going to look at me overnight and send me home, and then overnight I had really serious stomach pains. Ended up, I had what I think, and the doctors have looked at me, and are you sure, recently, and I've never seen my notes, but I was told in my early years that I had a lacerated pancreas.
Right.
And it caused real problems in my insides and my digestive system, and I was in hospital for 3 months. I was in intensive care for a couple of weeks, I think.
Age 7, this is?
Yes.
Wow.
And when they woke me up after a couple of weeks from intensive care, my mum tells this story of how she had to make a decision. Should they feed me or should they not? Because they weren't quite sure whether it had all healed or not, whether my digestive system would work, because they'd been feeding me with a tube while I was in intensive care.
Yeah.
And they said he'll either be fine and then he'll live a normal life, or he won't be fine and it could be really dangerous because it could kick something off in his digestive system. So my mum... And I'm forever grateful to her, although it was a big risk. She decided, let's feed him because I want him to have as much of a normal life as he can.
Thank
and
you,
it
Mom,
turned
right?
out fine. In fact, the first time I passed wind, they had a big party in the ward because that meant my digestive system was working fine. So as a 7-year-old, I wasn't quite sure why everyone was telling me. But the point I'm making is it made me... a few things happened. I became the centre of attention, which every 7-year-old loves, right? And I knew then... That because of that event, the love that I got as a consequence of that, and the kind of feedback that I got about how much I was cared for, and I can think about this in the past. I didn't notice at the time; it was just happening. And my teacher at the time made a few visits to the school she bought me, to the hospital she bought me books. She would all of the messages I got from this teacher that I could do whatever I wanted, I was great and I was worthy of investment. And I think that particular year at school had a big, profound impact on me. Because from then on, I found school relatively straightforward. I could perform quite easily. I could reach expectations. My reading and writing ability was really, really good. Maths, I kind of scraped by, but, you know, I was eloquent. I could speak for myself. And that's always been true since then. So I think that's a kind of seminal moment. And then...
Can I just pause it? Did you expect to tell that story?
No, today? I didn't. I was.
That's a really important story to you, isn't it?
I think it is, and I've thought about it a number of times. I've never told it out loud in something like this, but it's increasingly become something I've recognised, because it's easy to think of that as a disaster. You know, we mostly think of those injuries that we get or those moments in our childhood where we scraped through, and I was really lucky. What we tend not to think about those events as is actually they could be pivotal moments that seem like disasters at the time, but they could change our lives for the good in ways that we can't possibly expect later on. So, I think I tell that story because it says something about the complexity of life and unpredictability of our journey through life.
Have you told that story before, though?
Out loud?
Yeah.
Yes, but not in those terms.
Okay.
In that kind of recognize it as a turning point potentially.
Well, it sounds like a defining moment, doesn't it?
Yeah,
very much. That's almost like the essence of who you are.
Yeah, and I stayed in touch with that teacher all the way through school, and I went to a funeral about 10 years ago, less than 10 years, about 5 years ago, because I always had that kind of soft spot for her, and kind of recognized her as being really important to me in a kind of quasi parental space.
And if anyone wants to know why I continue passionately to do this podcast, it's for reasons like that, where we start to really delve into the human being, not just the human doing. And I think that there was actually an emotional element. I don't know whether you noticed it just in you telling that story. So I always say to people, I'm really humbled when people share stories like that, because it really is. That's you revealing the very heart of almost who you are, what you believe in, where you come. It's a defining
creates
moment.
Who you are, doesn't it?
It really does.
It creates your value. Your values are created in moments of like that. What you believe is important.
I agree. And if Gary Crotaz was in the studio early last week, I think he would probably call that an unlocked moment. It's really weird. The two guests I've had in since Gary have both, I think, identified an unlocked moment. Now, it's like all these things. Someone said to you, have you seen that? You know, you don't see something.
Yeah, there's a lot of research into that, isn't there?
So maybe I've become that. I want to ask you, in the journey that you've had, if I type into Google, what does leadership mean? I get 1,950,000,000 answers, which is deeply unhelpful. What does leadership mean to you, Graham?
I think at the heart of leadership is good judgment in the context you're in. And great leadership is making good judgments for the betterment of those around you and for the outcome you're trying to achieve. One of the big moments for me was leaving that Home Office immigration department.
Yep.
Was when I kind of recognised it wasn't necessarily in line with the values that I wanted to hold. I can't speak for anyone else. I'm only speaking for me.
Understood.
But I was doing things that weren't feeding my soul in terms of what I thought I was here for,
which is important.
And that was I found that out in a way that I wasn't expecting. I went to learn about leadership at Roffey Park actually, and I ended up doing this program that really asked me some serious questions about who I was and what I was here for that I wasn't expecting, and it kind of threw me off kilter for a while.
Yeah,
I went home and I said to my wife, I'm going to have to leave my job. I'm going to go and be a teacher. I didn't have a degree. I didn't have any qualifications. And she went, whoa, hang on a minute. I'm all for your ambition and changing your job, but we got a mortgage, we got two kids. Let's have a think. And she was absolutely right. So I wasn't able to just switch off, but it was
But the mindset had changed.
Yeah, I was no longer able to go to work fulfilled in doing what I was doing. Actually, it was recognised I wasn't fulfilled in doing what I was doing and I needed to do something different.
Yeah, and fulfilment came out as a big piece when I was researching my book, which now feels many years ago. Listen, I understand what it is that you do, Graham, but why do you do what you do?
There are so many answers to that. I think at the heart of it...
That's why I love this podcast episode.
At the heart of it is, honestly,
yep.
Roffey Park has had a profound effect on my life and at me fulfilling my potential. And to be able to work at Roffey Park and help others do that is a huge privilege. So first of all, doing what I do at Roffey Park is really important to me. And it was a kind of fulfillment of something for me to be able to do what I'm doing at Roffey Park. And to work with students on our masters and with the people that we work with in our research is to see the development of people in real time.
Yep.
You know, you see someone come on a master's program like I did in 2007. I turned up in 2007 knowing nothing about organizational development and having no idea what academic pursuits looked like. And Roffey Park nurtured me through that for 2 years. And I came out a very different person 2 years later. And I see that happening to our students now.
Right.
Through the process of working with each other and me and the faculty. And I've got people in my team. We validated our academic programs with the University of Sussex. The University of Sussex is our validation partner. So
okay, yeah.
You graduate from the University of Sussex and Roffey Park when you do our academic program.
Okay.
And my team have been working really hard for weeks now, getting.
That's not an easy process. I know that first.
I'm pleased to hear you say so, because that's my
validation.
Experience.
That's a big, so we big validated, undertaking.
We validated five programs yesterday, for delivery both online and face to face, and that's. Okay. The volume of paperwork involved in that endeavor.
You had a small truck deliver it.
And the detail involved is enormous. And I'm so proud of the people that work in my team. Okay. Can I name check them?
Please, let's do a bit of a shout out. I think we must.
We got Jan and Sue who did a lot of that. Hi, Jan and Sue. And James, who works in our research space. So we were all together yesterday, and this Sussex University were really gracious in their feedback, and they gave us a lot of really positive, I mean, loads of things we had to put right, like there always is in these processes, and you know, bits of paperwork we hadn't got quite right, but the essence of their feedback was that we were doing it, we had a great program of work, doing really successful studies, and some of our student feedback was involved in what they heard,
right.
So they talked to some of our students yesterday, and I think what I'm pointing at is the privilege of being able to work with students like I was worked with, and to support them in getting something around their potential and then what they will go on to in the future. And actually, Roffey Park's vision and mission, I think, is also about whether we're doing master's programs, whether we're doing research, whether we're doing executive programs, is over time, hopefully, creating a sea change in the number of people who think seriously about the well-being of their workforce. So when people who've been on our masters or on our executive programs end up in the C-suite, they will change the world potentially. And then I think we also have to think about the endeavours that we make and we help people make in changing the lives of the workforces. In the forgotten workforces is where we started.
Well, we did, didn't we? And I'm hearing huge elements of impact and fulfillment. What I'm going to do is I'm actually going to suggest that we actually do another episode where we could go a little bit deeper on the research, but I'm going to wet the whistle, for want of a better phrase. You've also done some research as regards how the pandemic has changed things for leaders. And I say to people, the landscape for leadership has changed. We're never going back to how it was. I'm going to put you on the spot slightly, and I'm going to say, and what you remember to be, what are the top three things, doesn't have to be in any order of priority, what are the top three things you think that came to the surface that are fundamentally different from anybody leading in a post-pandemic environment? And in no particular order, pop pickers.
Okay. I think number one, the genie is out of the bottle in terms of people being in an office 9 to 5 Monday to Friday.
Oh, my word, yeah.
I think it was coming out of the bottle anyway, but the pandemic just went, nope, can't do that anymore. Let me tell you a story.
I love a story.
I was working in a housing organisation at the time, and I had been talking to the leadership of that housing organisation about having some working from home policy. We didn't have any.
Right.
I was the HR director and organisation development director. And I was trying to kind of talk about how we could have some flexibility in having some of our work.
When was this? 21?
This would have been, I mean, it was the year before the pandemic.
So 21, 19.
I was still there as the, in fact, I decided to resign that job and go as an independent practitioner and consultant 3 months before the pandemic happened, but that's all.
There's another episode on timing.
Yes, exactly. As it happened, the pandemic was great for me, and I ended up working with some wonderful people online. Yep. Nevertheless, everyone had a desktop computer.
Yeah.
Everybody had a desk in the office of their own.
Yeah.
And they had their little family photographs on it and everything.
Their own space.
There was no shared space. There was none of that. Partly because it was in a place where they owned the building. The building was big enough for everyone.
Yep.
There was no need for shared space.
Okay.
And so there was no pressure on the finances or anything like that to make that happen. So I was having a real struggle saying, some people could work from home because some people have young kids. Some people have caring responsibilities for their elders and that kind of thing. And I was struggling to get this anywhere. And then the pandemic happened and the business went out and bought 1,000 laptops overnight, probably at the most expensive
time. Amazing what we can do when we have to, isn't
it? You could ever buy a laptop. I mean, it says something, you know, all of those change gurus that tell us you have to have a burning platform. You know, there was no more obvious example of that than the pandemic, was there? But so, and what happened was that I think there was some suspicion, and I think there still is in organisations, you know, when people are working at home, that somehow they're a bit lazy. They're watching quiz shows at lunchtime instead of working, and that, you know, that is, there's that kind of underpinning.
Well, the trust has got to be in place.
Lack of trust, yeah. And I think that was somewhat true of the place I was working in. So overnight, those who could work from home did. There were quite a lot, and I would put in the kind of forgotten workforce space who were gas fitters or electricians or carpenters or joiners who were maintaining the properties for this housing company, who had to go out to work.
Essential workers still.
Exactly. They had to go to work, but the rest of the workforce, the people who did the looking after the customers and looking after the admin of the organisation, they all just went home. And then we had to put technology in place, or the organisation had to put technology in place so they could take phone calls from home and be rooted back to them. So all of that's commonplace now.
What did it prove to us all then?
Well, Graham? I think it proved to us that it could be done and it could be done successfully. And the example I'm talking about,
and quickly,
I spoke to the senior leader sometime after I'd left the organisation, and he was completely converted because the bottom line didn't change. The expectations of income didn't get affected. People were able to work from home and work hard and deliver for the organisation.
It was an extraordinary experiment, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's why the genie's out of the bottle, because there's no evidence now to suggest we can't let people work at home.
So that's the first one, genie's out of the bottle in relation to that. Have you got another couple you can throw out for us?
I think that, well, another one is what we found in our research is that management development, leadership development needs to be thought of differently in terms of one of the most common ways of managing performance in organisations still today is time. We manage the number of hours someone's at work.
Yep.
It's the kind of one thing you can tangibly get hold of, and you know when someone started and when they came in and when they left.
Clock in, clock out. Now. Remember those days? Well, and maybe we don't. But
there are some people who would like to create the kind of software where you can manage that while people are at home. And that all starts to get a bit Orwellian, doesn't it, really?
Watch this space on those conversations, right?
So, but I think that genie's out the bottle as well, you know. So we can't rely on time to tell us how productive someone is. We've got to find new ways of managing and understanding productivity.
Right.
And that means about getting better at helping people with understanding what's expected of them and then whether they've done it or not.
Okay.
And then giving them some agency, some ability to make their own decisions about when they do it, where they do it, and how they do it.
Which is very much linked to the first, genie out of a bottle.
Okay. So, and I think we're still not very good at those things.
Number three.
And number three, which was unexpected in our research, is it's linked but not exactly a result of the pandemic, is people, now they've had their kind of, you know, they're starting to recognise they have some authority to make their own decisions and they're expected to make their own judgments.
Yep.
They're expecting, and increasingly society is inviting individuals to quite rightly in my view, to exercise their right to be recognised as an individual in their own diversity.
Right.
And the amount of diversity we're now understanding, because it was always there, It was just suppressed. Now, whether it's gender, whether it's race, whatever or whether it's neurodiversity, we are quite rightly being expected now to respond to that in the workplace. And I think that's a fantastic move forward. And managers are finding that really hard.
Because it becomes quite complicated, or they have a risk aversion to getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Not through mischief, just through getting it wrong.
Managing in a team, you might have a team of 10. Managing all of the individual expectations to respond to their diversity is a job in itself. Doing that and then getting them to work as a team to deliver for the organisation, which is what we're all paid for, is another job in itself. And they're often in tension with each other. And that was something that came strongly out of our research, that managers need help. They're really afraid to take a step because they don't know who they're going to upset or how they're going to upset them. And the other thing is, often, I think generational age takes a factor here. You know, so those of us who grew up, who were a bit older in life, have completely lost touch with the younger generation's expectations of having their individuality expressed and understood and respected and recognised. And we've got a big learning curve.
I think we're going to have a panel on this, actually. I'm going to get some people and get you back as well, Graham, and really dig a little bit deeper
into
this, because it keeps coming up as a theme, and it keeps coming up as a conversation. How do people get in touch? How do people connect with Roffey Park? Best way?
Roffey Park is Roffey Park Institute. Look us up in Google. You'll find us. We're based in Sussex, near a town called Horsham.
Right.
That's where we are, but we're very much online. You can look us up. You can get in contact with me or anyone in the team.
Yes.
Just look us up on the internet and you'll find our bio details and our contact details there.
Fine. I'll put those in the show notes as well, so that people can see those and actually click
through. And I'd love to hear from anyone who's interested.
Well, then I'll put in the details for you and check with you. Listen, Graham, thanks so much for taking the time to come into the studio. Have you enjoyed this?
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
Kind of good fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
And just having a human conversation as we explore the being over the doing, and that's what this is all about. Thank you for being a fan for it.
I especially like the kind of, we come in, we don't have a script, there's no plan, we just talk about what comes up, and I really like that.
Well, I think curiosity has always been, in some ways, the guiding light for everything that we do on the show. So thank you for being part of that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.